Good evening and welcome to our conversation with Dean of Students Alan Hart and Dean of First-Year Students Pat O'Hara. My name is Marcy Larman and I'm Director of On-Campus Programs and Alumni and Parent Programs. Also with us this evening is Betsy Cannon-Smith, Executive Director of Alumni and Parent Programs. Before we begin, I want to remind all our listeners that during the call, your phones are muted, so while you can hear us, we cannot hear you. You may email your questions to parents@amherst.edu. We'll ask as many of your questions, as well as those we've received previously, as time permits. Some questions may be summarized, and similar questions may be combined. This conversation is being recorded and will be posted on our website, amherst.edu, within a few days. Again, you may email your questions to parents@amherst.edu. Dean of Students Alan Hart, class of 1982, is a professor of psychology and has been on the Amherst faculty since 1996. He was the Dean of New Students from 2003 until 2010. As Dean of Students, he's consulted on all matters of general college policy involving students and is also available to provide general and academic counseling for all students. He has special responsibility for the class of 2013. Dean of New Students Pat O'Hara has been at Amherst for 28 years and is the Amanda and Lisa Cross Professor of Chemistry. She has special responsibilities for first year and other new students. She may be consulted on matters relating to the general and academic counseling of first year students, college regulations and requirements, the orientation program, and the first year seminar courses. Dean Hart, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Marcy. I'm happy to begin. Welcome, everybody, and I'm sorry that we meet this way for the first time. It really is a little disappointing, more than a little disappointing, that the start of our orientation or that first day of arrival that we worked so hard to put together was undermined by the weather. And I have fond memories of Dean O'Hara and I in past years kind of standing on the front steps of Converse Hall, opening the door to sort of the grand opening and welcoming students and families as they arrive on campus. So I'm really sorry that we've missed that opportunity, but I think we'll have other opportunities over the coming years to make up for that and to create new memories, long-lasting memories of time here at Amherst. I want to take a few minutes and just say a little bit about the Dean of Students Office, maybe a bit about our class dean's structure, and then maybe a quick introductory overview of where I see us in the school year and what some of the things are that we've just come through and then what to anticipate over the next several weeks or so. So I am the Dean of Students. I'm an alumnus from the college and have been on the faculty and the Dean of New Students for a while. For the last 2 years have been the Dean of Students. And I describe that role to students and certainly to the newer students as similar to a high school principal, that I kind of oversee many things that relate to students in general. I do have special responsibility for the class of 2013 is a group that I will follow through their graduation. We have a class dean system, and Dean O'Hara is the Dean of New Students, both the first year, first time students, those members of the class of 2015, as well as she does the oversight and orientation for transfer students and 12 college exchange students who are new to the campus as well. There's a class dean, Carolyn Bassett, who oversees the sophomore class, the class of 2014. Carolyn is inherited that class from Dean O'Hara last year and will stay with the class of 2014 through their graduation. And then I have the junior years, the class of 2013, and the seniors have been shepherded through Amherst by Shari Boykin East, who's been their class dean since they became sophomores a few years ago. And the class dean role allows us the opportunity to have a member of the Dean of Students Office to really get to know the class very well over the three-year window. Pat does her best to learn them very well their first year, and then when I was in that role, I tried to quickly unlearn as many names as possible to make room for the new names that were coming each year, whereas the other three class deans, myself included, have the luxury of spending 3 years with the group to get to know that group in a little bit more deeply. And so I think that's a system that's worked very well for us and really allows the opportunity for students to forge a deeper relationship with a member of the administration. And I think that's been very effective, and I think that's a model that we're very proud of. The last thing I would say before turning it over to Pat is to maybe talk a little bit about where we are in the school year and kind of what things have, what hurdles we've just cleared, and then what are the next few challenges that I see unfolding, you know, sort of within the pattern, within the rhythm of the school year. So we made it through that first 8 days of the orientation period, including the adjustments that we had to make for Hurricane Irene, and were able to get most students settled on campus. I forget the number now, but I think we had 435 first-year students on campus by Saturday night, the day before the Common First Day. And then many of you brave souls, or some brave souls, arrived on Sunday, and I forget that number, but maybe as many as 15 or 20 students and families arrived on during the hurricane. And then we resumed the activities as scheduled in the orientation brochure that Pat and her crew worked so hard to put together over the last year. And then that stretch of orientation led us to the start of the school year and advising registration and then course selection. And then that led us to the start of the school year, and we are now in the middle of the third week of class. And so we have cleared the official add drop period, and so students should have all classes set. And, you know, now it's sort of we start rolling through the academic demands of the semester really now start getting turned up. And what I think you will notice, if you haven't noticed already, is that, you know, our students make it through maybe the adrenaline-filled first couple of weeks of the semester, and in many cases have been reading along with the material and feeling comfortable with the material and think they have a strong command of the material. But now they're going to start to be tested in a different way, and maybe more formally tested in terms of having papers due and having quizzes and exams start to pop up. And I think this presents another set of challenges for those who really will be pushed to demonstrate that they've mastered the material in a way that they probably have never been asked to before. And so my sense is what happens over the next couple of weeks is students start to see grades that they've never seen before. Those who are used to A's and maybe an A minus occasionally are likely to see some grades that have more bends and twists in them than just an A does. And so for us, I see our challenge as the Dean of Students Office is to help students understand when they get a grade that that's not the end of the conversation. In many ways, that's the beginning of the conversation. And I fear that students will get feedback that they're not used to getting and panic or hide under the bed or think that they don't belong or think that, you know, something tragic has happened, when in fact it's really the case that the comments that students will see if they take the time to read the written comments on the papers really will be an invitation to learn more from the professors about the nature of the feedback and ways to improve or to better understand what's being asked of them. And so that will be the challenge, I think, for the next few weeks as students begin to get feedback and then figure out what to do with that. So I hope that they will take that as an invitation, not to challenge the grades and try to squeeze more points out of the instructor, but rather to fully engage the conversation and to become active learners and active participants in their educational process. The other thing I'm afraid will start happening is that students will start getting sick. And I've heard, we were in Johnson Chapel the other night, and I could hear coughs around the room start to pick up, and some, you know, pretty substantial coughs. So I think another hurdle that students will have to overcome is getting sidetracked or derailed, or maybe getting sick in a way that might cause them to miss a class or be under the weather a little bit. And again, to be able to not get too far off track or fall too far behind, but kind of weather that storm as well. And sort of make it through the midpoint of the semester. Excuse me. So I think that's all I want to say, more than I probably meant to say for the introductory remarks, but I'll turn it over to Pat to add a few words as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Hi, everybody. This is Pat O'Hara. I'm the Dean of New Students, as you heard, and also a professor of chemistry. And I'm really, really sorry we didn't get a chance to say hello and greet you all on that Sunday morning that was very wet. But instead, I did want to say that, you know, we've decided to try to have an open house on the Saturday morning of Family Weekend at 9 o'clock in the Dean's office. We've never done this before. We'd really look forward to meeting some of you. If you can stop by the dean's office at that point, that would be really terrific, and that's in Converse Hall. Where it's open for any parents, but I'd especially love it if new parents could stop by and say hello. And in addition, after that, as normally happens on family weekend, the President Biddy Martin will actually be addressing the assembled folks at 10 a.m. in Johnson Chapel on the Saturday. So we'd really look forward to having you there. I know you missed out on meeting Biddy, as she likes to be called, and so we hope that you can both come by and see us in Converse Hall at 9 and then get over to Johnson Chapel to hear Biddy Martin speak at 10 a.m. And I'm sure you'll have just about the same reception to her as we do. We love her already, so we're looking forward to working with her in the coming year. I wanted to say a little bit about orientation, because there were definitely some, the first day's activities, which featured a lot of welcomes and a lot of greetings, were canceled. But many of those events having to do with students and student groups will be rescheduled. But the major overhauls that were probably not so visible to you in the orientation programming involved restructuring some of the academic issues all into the first 2 days. And what that enabled us to do, we moved other programming around in the week, and we made sure that every new student had 1 hour with their academic advisor on Tuesday. Given the fact that Amherst is an open curriculum, we feel that the choice of courses, the discussion about what a student is actually here to do, which is so much more than just I want to be an econ major or be a psych major, the more deep conversations about what they want to do at college, what is it they want to learn, could happen in those one-hour slots. So that was actually a fairly major change to the orientation programming, which feedback from both faculty and students was that that was very successful. And then the next couple of days were focused on a lot of the social issues about talking about how one can get along in the dormitories and having mutual respect for one another. And we then ended up the week with outreach trips into the community. So there were some events of dancing and singing and other kinds of wonderful events throughout the week. And a new program, which I'll actually talk a little bit more about later, is extended orientation, which is now ongoing as we realize that any introduction to what I would like to call as the Amherst experiment is not something that you can do in just 1 week at the very beginning before the students have actually had a chance to experience Amherst. So we've introduced a program of ongoing orientation, which I can talk about a little bit later. So the orientation, just to wrap it up, ended up with Senator Coons did make it actually from Delaware through the hurricane on the Monday of orientation. And then the next Monday was President Martin's convocation address to the college, which was a wonderful discussion of her hopes and dreams for the year, and ones that I'm sure she'd like to share with you on November 6th. So maybe we can turn it back to Marcy.
Great, thank you. We had several questions having to do with the five college system and the courses that are available. Parents would like to know how decisions are made on what courses are granted credit. And also, one parent writes that she's heard that students from other colleges get preferential treatment if they want to enroll in Amherst College courses. And they want to know if that's true and how that's handled. So if you could address that.
Let me take that first, and then maybe Pat could. I'll take those first two, and then Pat can take subsequent questions about the five college consortium. So how a course is getting credit, I think, was one part of the question. So there's a, Amherst has been part of the Five College Consortium for a number of years, dating back to at least 30 years back when I was a student. The Five College Consortium was in effect. and really allows for the free movement between the different campuses for academic and social and professional reasons. In terms of courses, on average, Amherst students take between one and two courses in the five-college system. So students are active in the five-college exchange, but not as much as some of the other schools that tend to travel more freely across the different campuses. The handling of academic credit at Amherst is done directly through the registrar's office. And what happens is the registrar's office typically will review every single course, five college, or also courses that students want to take in other exchange programs, either for study abroad or for the 12 college exchange program. But those are courses that are vetted through the registrar's office, and their decision criterion as to whether or not they'll give Amherst College credit for the course really is precedent, whether or not credit has been given for it before, or if it's a liberal arts class. And so any liberal arts class within the five college area is automatically really given credit or serves as credit within the Amherst College curriculum as well, and can serve as one of the 32 courses that all Amherst College students must take to graduate. So the vetting of courses is done strictly through the registrar's office. I think the second part of the question was about preferential treatment and whether or not five college students are given preferential treatment over Amherst College students for Amherst courses. And that just simply is not true. It's not the case that five college students are getting preferential treatment in any kind of blanket way across the campus. There might be, and I have not heard of this, but there might well be a particular situation where a professor might want a certain kind of mix or maybe give seniority to an upper-class student from another college over an Amherst College student. And I could imagine for pedagogical reasons why that might make sense. But I have not heard of any kind of systematic preference given for non-Amherst students over Amherst students for an Amherst class.
In addition to enrollments at the other campuses, which are, by the way, not allowed for first semester, first year students, we do think that the first semester especially is a moment when the students really are should have as a priority getting to know their campus and getting to know the faculty at this campus. But later on, every student I've ever spoken to is really feels very enriched by the five college interaction, and there's no reason why as an advisor we wouldn't want to ask our students to think about a five college course. There, just simply put, are some courses that you other campuses specialize in. There are some upper-level science courses at UMass that students could take at the graduate level as an undergraduate and get credit for those, for example. So there really is lots of benefits of taking courses in the five colleges. But there are also five college programs, and those are different than five college courses. So there are a number of programs where there's not actually a department at any one campus, but that the five colleges collaborate and cooperate together to put a professor on a particular campus at any one moment. And so often there will be a five college course might actually be taught on Amherst College campus. So the five college language program is an example of that. The language courses can be taught on any of the five campuses, and they rotate around. The bus system is really quite easy to negotiate, and most students, as I said, do find it a really fulfilling experience.
As a sort of follow-up to that, someone asks if it's possible that Italian will be offered in the near future. This is a language that their son was hoping to pursue after studying Latin for 8 years, and he knows that it's available on other campuses, but I wondered if it would be offered here.
So Italian is not likely to be offered at Amherst. We do not have an Italian department on campus, but Italian is a language that our students regularly take at the university. It's very popular, and we have students every semester, including first-year students, who are allowed to take five college courses, take Italian in particular. So it's a very popular course. The bus is an easy straight shot to the other side of town. The bus is free. And so Italian and some of the other language courses, in particular that Professor O'Hara speaks of, Arabic is another one that's gotten very, very popular. And occasionally there are some levels of the Arabic that are offered on our campus, but that it really is a five-college language that if you take more than one or two courses over your time here, you're likely to take those on a variety of different campuses. So Italian, we encourage students to pursue those interests, especially to the extent that it is tied in with their interest in the international experience and perhaps studying abroad. That that's one of the real strengths of being in the five-college community, that it extends our academic reach and resources far beyond what we can offer here in maintaining kind of our small, intimate campus. So Italian is something that we encourage students to take, and students do readily take Italian at the university every semester.
Thank you. We had a few questions about the issue of alcohol abuse on campus, and could you please address Amherst's efforts to deal with questions of alcohol use both on and off campus for students?
No, absolutely. Alcohol and really other drugs, all drugs, are an issue and concern of ours in the Dean of Students Office. I would preface my remarks by saying I don't feel that we have an alcohol problem more so than our peers, but in that sort of relative comparison, you know, you sort of compare yourself to peers and to institutions that are populated by students between the ages of 18 and 22. And I think there are clearly behaviors that students participate in that adults or older adults would find strange and perhaps excessive. But we have a lot, we pay a lot of attention to alcohol and other drugs on campus, and we have a variety of programming, both active and passive types of programming that I can talk a little bit about. As well as the enforcement of the laws of the land that we have to abide by, that dictate a lot of our policies and practices. But so let me talk a little bit about some of the things that we do offer. And I've got it really broken down, or I think about broken down in several different areas. The first is a general area I call policies and practices that relate to both the law and the enforcement of the law, but also practices on campus. So, for example, all kegs are banned in first-year dorms, and actually there's a state laws that regulate the purchase of kegs that make it very, very difficult for someone to purchase a keg. So that has changed the culture on campus significantly over the last 20 or so years. through our campus center director, all official parties have to be registered through the campus center, and the director of the campus center is Dean Hannah Fatimi, who regulates the party policy on campus. And so any official party involving alcohol has to go through the Dean of Students and Campus Center Student Activities, where there are a number of regulations about the serving of alcohol, the monitoring, the kind of informal policing of what goes on at parties where alcohol is served. There also is a campus police force on campus, and these are trained police officers who go through the Massachusetts State Police Academy, who also enforce campus policy and the laws related to alcohol use, consumption, and possession. We have a variety of programs on education, alcohol and other drug education, ranging from the training that our resident counselors go through at the beginning of the year. We have student health educators, peer advocates, and ASIMs, our own medical staff on campuses, upper-class students who are trained in kind of emergency first responder type training. We have dorm talks and mandatory orientation events that talk about alcohol use, abuse, and the resources on campus. Variety of alternative programming, and we work very hard, again, through the student activities, through the resident counselors and the Dean of Students Office, to offer substance-free housing and other events during the week that that feature kind of non-alcohol related activities. And one, and then maybe Dean O'Hara will talk about maybe the Campus After Dark or some of the other programs that sort of encourage alcohol-free socializing. Do you want to?
Sure. There's a large initiative that's coming out of the student body to formalize programming where alcohol is not the center of the socializing that happens. And I'm sure as parents you all realize that things are most successful when it is your children who've thought them up. And these programs are incredibly wonderfully diverse as the kids are themselves, as the students are. And they range from things like tango dancing, which happens regularly on Friday nights, to dominoes that get played in the dorms with the students and faculty and invited deans. I myself do ice cream making events in each of the freshman dorms. But one of the most, or some of the most spectacular ones I've heard about was over the, I think it was last weekend for sure, there was just an event run through the campus center where students could come and just write. The idea being that they're so used to the Twitter and the Facebook and the bits and the bytes that very few of them have ever actually sat down with stationery and stamps and actually composed a letter. And Alan, do you remember the number? It was
300.
300 students showed up to write letters. And it lasted for 3 hours into the evening on a Saturday night. And at the end, the students were saying they wished they could have come earlier. So there is a big, I think, curiosity about the ways in which these really interesting and new ways of getting together as a group of people that don't involve alcohol. It's also true that sometime in the near future, Amherst will be running an Amherst Unplugged Day, which is where we really encourage our students to not be on Facebook, to not be texting, to put away all of those electronic gadgets that keep them what feels like often distracted from the person who's sitting right across from them. And so if that, sorry, I'm not remembering the date, but if you don't get a text or email from your child on that day, don't be alarmed. We've just asked them to just step away from their iPhone or their computer.
Well, the date is wonderful. It's 11-11-11.
That's right. I should have remembered that. 11-11-11. Unplugged.
Thank you. Well, let's move from drinking to eating for a minute. The next question is that regards the long lines in Valentine. This parent writes, our son has experienced long lines at Valentine Dining Hall. We've never heard any complaints before about functional operation from their other college students, and can this be improved? They add, happily, he said the food is quite good.
I'll start on an answer to that, and maybe Pat can jump in as well. I eat at Valentine on a regular basis, and it is change. In some ways, the changes are subtle, but I think they're also significant. In particular, in terms of the flow of traffic this year, there have been some significant changes to Valentine to increase the flow and try to distribute students a little bit more widely around the servery. But when the schedule is compressed, particularly around lunchtime, given the nature of when classes are offered and when there's those crunches, when people have a few minutes in between classes and they're coming from one and they've got to get to the second and trying to make a quick stop at Valentine, that it can be complicated to have 1,200 students showing up at the same time to be able to move through Valentine in a quick way. So there are some timing issues that I think make that a little bit complicated. But we're certainly aware of that. And the one thing that about Valentine's for me that is so interesting and wonderful about Amherst is that we all eat in the same dining hall. So the sense of community that comes from that, I think is really powerful and can't be overstated. And one way one can imagine to solve the problem is to open up multiple dining halls around campus, but that would really divide us in ways that I think would really undercut the overall Amherst experience. There are some alternatives, and there's the Schwemm's snack bar in the campus center, and a number of people go there. But for the most part, we all eat in one central location, which is really a great strength of Amherst's community. So, it's sort of good news and bad news there. But we are aware of the traffic flow problems. We continue to change the layout inside Valentine to change the traffic flow. And this year, for example, moving, so you on the phone who have sophomores in your family will notice that the drink dispensers have been moved out of the central servery area, which actually has done very well, has done made great strides towards changing the flow of traffic and reducing sort of the bottleneck rate as students enter Valentine or the main serving area. There's also some subtle changes in, there's another opening. They sort of punched a hole in the wall and created another entrance and exit in and out that has also improved the flow of traffic as well. And then in general, there's some improvements around the lighting, the new flooring, and so there have been some other significant changes made to Valentine as well. But we are at those peak hours, the traffic can be a problem. So one of the things I would just add and then turn it and then let Pat jump in is also to say that Valentine actually posts the traffic flow patterns on their website. So you can go online and look to see when the peak hours are and to know, you know, on a Wednesday, from Wednesday at noon is a high traffic time. And so if you can eat lunch at 11 or 1, that you can really avoid some of that crunch.
So I actually just came from Val, so and I will report that the food tonight was excellent. I had vindaloo, I had a really nice salad, and a piece of flounder, and it was just really terrific. I did grab an ice cream, I confess, on the way out. The first years may feel this more than other students because so many of them have first-year seminars together on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 to 12:20. And so all but 70 of them or so are rushing to get lunch at the same time. I think as they progress through their curriculum at the college and as their course selections dephase, then they won't all be crunched together at the same time. So if your first-year student is reporting that lunch is an issue on those Tuesdays and Thursdays, that's what's most likely happening. I don't, you know, see a real problem when I'm over there at dinner, but, you know, I think if they're doing the best they can, I think the food is fantastic. And the other great thing is staff and faculty eat there as well. So, and sometimes some faculty families eat there as well. So, local townspeople come in for Sunday brunch sometimes because it's such good food and they just like the atmosphere.
Thank you. Our next question is, can parents be notified if their children are struggling academically? And on a similar subject, can a poor grade be mitigated in some way?
I'll take the first part, and Pat, you want to take the second part maybe. So can parents be notified if their students are struggling academically? It turns out that there's actually federal laws that prohibit the sharing of educational records without the expressed written permission from students. So once your students become 18, or if they're not 18 but attend a post-secondary, you know, a college, come to Amherst, that the rights and responsibilities shift from the parents to the students themselves. And so the federal guidelines, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, prohibit us from sharing directly without written consent from your students to share their academic records with you. So I think in those situations, really the best source of information is your students or are your students themselves. With their permission, we can share records, but you know, that's sort of a cumbersome process, and I think the best way to get that accurate information is directly from the students themselves. And we do have, there are a few exceptions to, it's called FERPA, the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act. The only exceptions to that are school officials have access to student records and the academic advisor has access to the records. When students want to share their grade, if they're transferring or applying to a particular program, sometimes their records can be shared, but that we do not send grade reports directly to families or send home or even to students themselves now. Now when the grades are due at the end of the semester, the students will get access to them electronically and they can go online and look at their grades, but the grades are not sent home anymore either. And that's also under the guidelines or under the restrictions of FERPA, this federal law that protects educational records.
So maybe I can address the questions. Is there anything in particular a student can do if their grades are particularly bad in a course? And again, my focus is a little bit on the first year experience. And the one thing I would like to say about the first year experience is that we so encourage students to explore the curriculum, and we the rhetoric of the college is that not to take courses that they're just comfortable in, that they know that they actually are successful in, but to take courses that cause them to reach a little bit. In addition, there are many, many disciplines, my own of chemistry, where the different preparations that students bring with them is enormous to their first year experience. So one thing we allow students to do in math and languages and chemistry is if they find themselves in a course that's too challenging, they can drop a level down. And that can happen fairly into like the first month of the semester. And then beyond that, we also have extraordinary resources of academic support. The Writing Center, the Q Center. If a student is in real academic difficulty, they can actually get themselves a peer tutor from the Dean of Students Office. And then sometimes the situation just can't be saved for a first-year student. They've gotten themselves in over their head. And in that case, in the sixth, seventh, and eighth week of the semester, a student can actually petition to drop a class. That's only allowed for first-year students, and it's only allowed once. And it's a petition to drop, not the right that they have to drop a class. So in the middle of October, students are given warning grades if they're having difficulty in a class. So the students will have to, again, log on to AC Data. It's not something that they're sent in the mail. Hopefully a professor has communicated through the grade on a paper or just personally to the student that they're in some severe academic distress. And at that point, we make sure the student is making use of all the resources that they have, try to give it another shot, but if it ends up just being outside their grasp, we let them drop that class without a consequence. The meaning of that means it appears as a W, no credit on the academic record, but that they're not, they don't have to repeat the class, they don't have to take it again, and that doesn't factor into their overall GPA. That's true for all classes except first-year seminar. You cannot drop your first-year seminar.
Can I just follow up as well with a slightly different direction? I talked a little bit about FERPA, which protects educational records. There's also federal guidelines about health information privacy called HIPAA, referred to as HIPAA, the Health Information Privacy Act, which does a similar kind of thing with health and medical records, that they are protected and again, can only be released under expressed written consent from the student. We do, with the following exceptions, that if there's an instance where we think a student's health is at risk or they're in danger of harming themselves or harm to other people, that we can violate that confidentiality and take particular steps of action at that point. But the two federal laws that really guide our behavior, both in terms of the release and sharing of educational records is FERPA, and the release and sharing of medical information is called HIPAA.
Thank you. On a slightly different tack, a parent writes, I was pleased to learn that freshman student athletes met as a group with administrators and coaches and would be attending a series of such meetings in the future. Could you please share what the purpose and message of the meetings are and how best parents can buttress both their student athletes and athletes at Amherst, and athletics at Amherst, sorry.
So the events that were planned during the first couple of days of the semester of orientation had to do with a new program that we're pretty excited to have at Amherst College with the varsity athletes, and it's called the Amherst Leads Program. And it really is involved in leadership development, and it provides a comprehensive and educational view of leadership, and it can be used both during and after a student athlete's experience at Amherst College. These programs are set up to actually help develop character, to take the captains of the different teams. They go through a special workshop together before orientation starts, and they really work to try to not only bond the students together, but also to create a sense of community and a buddy system such that they're looking out for one another. The program has a first-year component, the first-year initiative program, and all varsity athletes are invited to that program, and we've had a lot of success in that program. I'd also like to take this opportunity to also mention that the coaches themselves are an enormous asset even to us in the Dean of Students Office. We consider them colleagues. We consult with them regularly. We work with them, and we find the coaches themselves are, as I said, just often know your children better than anyone else on campus, and so we get enormous amount of support from them, and we like to support them as well. In addition, each team has a faculty member who's a faculty liaison, and that faculty member typically is a person, sometimes their child played that sport, sometimes they played the sport, sometimes they just wished that they played the sport, and so those faculty liaisons are another source of an interface between the athletics, which is so we're so proud of at the college, as well as the academics. And the liaison system has been in place for at least about 5 years. And again, I think this is something not too many other schools have, and I think it's a great source of connecting that student athlete, the student part, the athlete part.
Thank you. We always get several questions about the final exam schedule and how students and parents can plan for their plane tickets, for their travel to and from. Can you talk a little bit about how that information is passed along and what students can expect?
Yeah, I'll start with that one. At the beginning of the semester, the registrar's office, which oversees the scheduling of final exams and those formal in-class final exams that will show up at the end of the semester, what the registrar's office solicits from each instructor of each class what their intentions are in terms of a final exam for each class. And many professors don't, you know, it's a written, maybe it's a paper final or an unscheduled exam, or sometimes they have an exam during the last week of class. But for those faculty members who go through the formal exam period at the end of the semester, those exams are scheduled through the registrar's office. So the registrar's office compiles this information, and then they actually go through by hand to try to minimize the number of scheduling conflicts that any one particular student might have. So they try to smooth it out and to both avoid scheduling conflicts, but also try not to overtax a student so that a student might have any more than two exams on a particular day. And so we're just in the middle of that process now. So the registrar's office is still compiling the information from faculty, and then we'll come out with the final exam schedule sometime during the middle of the semester. And so right now, I believe the semester is scheduled to end. The last day of classes is Wednesday, December 14th. That's followed by a three-day reading study period from the 15th through the 17th, and then the exams, scheduled final exams, will start on Sunday, December the 18th. And so at the moment, students might not be aware. They can look on the syllabus that they have for each class and to see whether or not there is a final exam and whether or not it's going to be scheduled during the exam, during the classes, in which case it's probably already scheduled right now. But if they're going to have a final exam scheduled by the registrar's office, that information is probably not yet available for all classes. And so it does make scheduling return trips home or travel around the break between the semesters a little bit more complicated. But that is information that we work with the registrar's office, and we try to push them along to do that as quickly as possible, because I know that travel plans are complicated, and the sooner families can make those, the more efficient and the more cost-efficient it is to make those plans as soon as possible. But so it's a little bit of a cumbersome schedule at this point, but it's really designed to try to minimize the pressure and the stress on the students at the end of the semester, so they're not confronted with an exam schedule that is heavily burdened on one particular day.
Just one thing to add to that is I would also urge a discussion with your children about not only when their exams are scheduled, but when their papers are due. Faculty often have papers due during the exam period and final papers, and it's not a good idea for a student to go home before they've handed in that paper. Sometimes students think that's going to work out well, and we've had a long history of it not working out so well. So please do encourage, try to work with your kids to get a day where they've finished handing in their academic work, and then they can go home and take a break.
Yeah, and I would add on to that that there's a long break in January. We have this interterm in January where classes don't begin, officially begin, until January 23rd, Monday, January 23rd. So students are facing a long break already, and I worry that sometimes students try to prioritize squeezing another day or two in December to try to leave campus as quickly as possible before all that academic work is done. And I would really caution against that as well. In particular, trying to make arrangements now without knowing when those final exams are scheduled can be very tricky because some, you know, people, faculty members and departments can be very, very idiosyncratic about what accommodations they can allow and can't allow. And so I would caution students to and families to not jump the gun too much here to try to squeeze a few days out or trying to guess when they'll be able to leave. Because it can really cause some problems, both in terms of scheduling as well as the thorough completion of all the academic work that needs to be done before a student can take that break. And knowing full well that during January they don't have to be back here until really the start of classes on the 23rd or a few days before then, so that it's typical that students will have at least a three-week break or even a four-week break is pretty standard, regardless of when the final exam is scheduled.
Thank you. We have a follow-up question here to something you referred to earlier, Pat. This parent asks about the four mandatory sessions that are the extended orientation program. They say that topics are obviously important: intellectual honesty, respect for persons, race and class in the classroom, and resiliency and health. But they question whether having it at night when students are also working on their schoolwork is, they wonder about the logic to that.
So, yeah, thanks for the opportunity to actually talk a little bit more about this. Is another new piece to the orientation programming that comes out of a committee of students and coaches and faculty and deans. And in the discussions over the year, there was an acknowledgement of the fact that the orientation period is, in fact, pretty brief to try to really orient students to life at Amherst College. One of the very overarching goals of orientation and the first-year experience is to really build the sense of community. Students in typical have never really experienced the kind of diversity that they find. Many of them are away from home for the first time. And we really wanted to be intentional about trying to build this community. Another thing that we recognized last year, and this was not just deans and faculty, but the students themselves, was that there were elements of orientation, for example, intellectual integrity, which talked about how one has to be credible in the work that they do, that students were having before they'd ever stepped foot in an Amherst College classroom and had never really experienced writing a paper where they were going to have to cite sources. So it became clear to the committee and mostly to the students involved that a better way of doing this would be to sort of spread out some of these really important discussions until the students had a little bit of experience under their belts. And in talking about this, we recognize there was no good time once the semester started to have this be without some struggle. That is, there was programming 24/7 at the college, and so we were going to have to try to minimize the obstructions as compared with just getting rid of them altogether. We thought that that was an important enough issue to take the risk and to put this into some mandatory continuing orientation. And the concepts that we're talking about, respect for persons, race and class in the classroom, and then a final session on resilience. We've done it in such a way where we know what the academic profile is of the semester. We know when the students are going to start to feel the pinch of demanding essays, high expectations for written work. We know when the issues of dorm life and ideas of what's happening on the athletic fields. And finally, we know when the semester stress is going to be building to the point where explicitly and intentionally, again, talking as a community about that stress and how to get rid of it and mitigate it. We thought that we did this intentionally the way we at opportune moments when the message would be most relevant. In addition, we wanted to bring in members of the community who might not otherwise have been able to speak during the orientation moment itself. And we've worked hard to get multiple people, multiple voices heard that they wouldn't have heard during the orientation session. And so, as I said, it is an experiment. We may choose to do things a little bit differently this year, but I guess I would hope that I could count on you, parents and family, to sort of allow the expectation that this is an important programming that will have long-term benefits. And if they could just get that essay they need to get for their first year seminar done a little bit earlier in the evening or later in the evening or maybe even on the weekend before, then it wouldn't that hour, 8:30 to 9:30 on Monday, wouldn't seem so burdensome.
Thank you. And I would add, you know, orientation is already so full and complicated, and people tease us for having a very long orientation already, that I really am hesitant to think about adding more to those first few days when it is so important for students just to get acclimated and feel that they belong here. That I think some of the most important messages would just not be heard in those first few days when so much other stuff is going on. So, Pat, I think that was very articulate and well-explained rationale for this new programming.
Thank you. We've got about 4 minutes left. Would you like to make a few closing summary comments?
Can I just talk about one other topic, and I'll try to do it quickly before closing. And that was in today's Amherst Student, there's a column on the front page about the Dean of Students Office and the AAS, the student government, joining forces to tackle social life changes on campus. And so I'm very proud of the work that we started together in collaboration with the Dean of Students Office and some other administrative offices on campus, campus police, health and safety, and facilities, to work with student government in particular to respond to changes in recent laws that have affected the social life as it's unfolded on campus over the last several years. So if people are not aware that there was a law passed this summer in regards to crowd management, and it actually comes out of a concern for a terrible fire that occurred in Rhode Island, I believe in 2003, at a club called The Station, where there was a fire that quickly engulfed a building and close to 100 people died on the site, that has led to changes in the, well, not changes in laws, led to new laws within the state of Massachusetts regulating activities around parties and then how parties are defined and then what that means for activity on our campus. The bottom line being that some of the social dorms that have hosted parties in the last several years will not be allowed to host big parties from this point moving forward. And so that's changed the planning for some of the parties that were planned in advance by students for this year, but also provides us an opportunity to think about how we would like to more proactively change and shape the social life on campus. So we started with several meetings in the last week or two with the student government that have led to the formation of a social life task force that has representatives from the Dean of Students Office, the student body from different constituencies, campus police, health and safety, and facilities, to try to work together with students to think about not only trying to replicate some of the parties they have, but also, and this is a word that I've heard President Martin use several times in the last few weeks since we got to know her a little bit, aspirational ways, but ways to inspire, not to just replicate what we've always done, but how we'd like to shape the social life so you know, so that we can aspire to new types of social life and new types of programming, more inclusive and related to the alcohol question, to the extent that we can also encourage, you know, non-alcoholic alternatives as well. So I'm very excited about the collaboration that we started with student government to really address some of these issues head on.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Well, this concludes our conversation with Dean Hart and Dean O'Hara, and I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. I want to remind you that we're hoping each and every one of you will be coming to Family Weekend on November 4th, 5th, and 6th. We have a very full program, and you can see that on our website, and keep checking back because more things are added all the time. I hope that your students are having a wonderful time here at Amherst, and we appreciate that you took the time to join us for this conversation this evening. Thank you.
Thank you.